Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming on a what turned out to be rather snowy Saturday morning, but you're glad all of you all here. And most importantly, we're glad to have the panelists here to discuss what has become an extremely interesting issue, particularly in applied originalism. One of the revolutionary changes in the last decade or so has been the application of originalist principles to criminal law and particularly criminal procedure. Professor Bibas and I were privileged enough to actually be clerking for the court when it began embarking on this enterprise, which is in a case called Almendarez-Torres, where they began to explore what the originalist implications are. And it's created an interesting debate that has really moved originalism from extremely abstract issues into a very concrete application to figure out how these principles played out. And we are privileged to have two of the leading experts on this field to discuss with us today. Our first speaker will be Professor Jeff Fisher of Stanford Law School. The rest of his bio is in your program, but among the other things, he co-directs the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic. He will speak first. And then Professor Stefanos Bibas, who is a professor of law here at Penn, who is also a director of a Supreme Court clinic here, and perhaps they'll end up crossing swords in more than one form. Professor Fisher.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be invited to be part of this conference and this panel with my colleagues. You have a lot of fabulous people here, and I'm privileged to be included among them. And it's also the first time I've been to Penn, so it's a double privilege to be here today. Although having said all that, I will say that having flown in from the West Coast last night and then getting put on the 9 a.m. panel East Coast time, I think maybe you're trying to take advantage. And then you make me walk here in the snow. But I appreciate, again, the opportunity to be here. I was looking through the materials, and I saw, unfortunately, I wasn't able to be here, but a panel last night involved whether originalism is a rationalization for conservatism or rather is a a principled theory of interpretation. And I think that's a wonderful place to begin framing the debate that we're going to have today. Because I'm sure as you discussed last night, oftentimes originalism is thought as, or at least criticized as a way to simply get to conservative results. And you can look at certain cases where indeed the court does divide among liberal conservative lines where originalism is on the conservative side of the case. Heller might be a particularly prominent recent example of that. But when you turn to criminal procedure, things are not so simple. We're going to talk particularly about two lines of cases today. The first, the one that Professor Yu mentioned, involving the Supreme Court's reinvigoration of the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial, and second, the Supreme Court's recent reinvigoration of the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation. In both of these areas, the court has divided sharply. But what's interesting is in both of these areas, they've divided sharply across ideological lines. So in both of the lines of the cases we're going to be discussing, the court has proceeded primarily with a five-member majority. Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and then Justice Stevens, Justice Ginsburg, and Justice Souter. On the other hand, you've had, at least initially, you had Chief Justice Rehnquist and Sandra Day O'Connor and Justice Kennedy in the dissent, along with Justice Breyer, and now Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito have stepped seemingly quite naturally into the shoes in this debate of Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice O'Connor. In fact, I'm going to speak a little bit autobiographically at points today because I've been involved in many of these cases, but as somebody who represented defendants in these cases and given that criminal defense work is often associated with perhaps a liberal point of view or the like, when President Bush had two vacancies on the Supreme Court and said, I'm going to appoint people in the mold of Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, I was perhaps one of the only people with these kinds of cases that was saying, fantastic, that'll be great, I'll pick up two votes. But as it happened, if you measure this area of law, President Bush gave us people much more in the mold of Chief Justice Rehnquist, which has not turned out so well for me so far in terms of picking up votes. But again, the reason that I think this is a great conversation to have is because it forces you to think. It forces everybody to think about what originalism really means, about what constitutional jurisprudence really should be about. So let me turn first to the right to jury trial, and I'll outline each of these areas a little bit and then say a few words about them. So as Professor Yu mentioned, this debate about the right to jury trial has been going on now for a little bit more than a decade. It arose primarily because of a rather modern innovation by legislatures and Congress. What they did is they stepped in starting in the 1980s, and rather than when they wanted to criminalize a new act or increase the punishment for a new act, simply enacting a new crime or enacting an aggravated version of a crime, they stepped in and started to designate what they called sentencing factors. And a sentencing factor would be a particular fact that the legislature identified as aggravating the crime, and that would increase, subject the defendant at least to an increased sentence, often severely increased sentence. But instead of the traditional mode of letting the letting that issue be charged in the indictment and proved beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury, they left it to the judge to find after the defendant was convicted of the base crime to find this fact by preponderance of the evidence and to increase the defendant's sentence if the judge decided that was appropriate. So the first time that the court really applied this as a constitutional matter was a case called Apprendi versus New Jersey in 2000. In that case, the state of New Jersey had made assault a crime punishable by 10 years in prison, but the legislature had stepped in and said, but if the defendant picked his victim on the basis of racial animus, then a five-year increase in the sentence is permissible. So that's what happened. That's what Mr. Apprendi was charged with, and then after he was convicted of assault, and after trial, the judge decided that he had indeed picked his victim based on racial animus and increased his sentence to 12 years. And the five-member majority that I spoke of earlier held that violated the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial. Now, as I see it, and Professor Bevis wants to take me on this, but as I see it, I think Apprendi was actually a fairly easy case, if you care really at all about the history and tradition of the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial. Because there, you had just a classic case, in my view, of an aggravated crime. Think of just everyday examples of the difference between armed robbery and robbery, the difference between murder and manslaughter. They all include an extra element or an extra fact that makes the crime worse, and we've always assumed that the jury would find that fact. And the reason why we've assumed the jury would find that fact is not necessarily because the jury is a better fact finder, a more accurate fact finder than the judge. But when you look at the history of the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial, what you'll find is the reason the jury had to find these facts, or at least they had to be proved to the jury, was so that the jury could engage in what I think is most accurately described, even though the Supreme Court has shied away from this term, but is most accurately described as a limited nullification right of the jury. At the time of the founding, most felonies were punishable by death. And the juries knew that, and they knew if they convicted defendants of certain crimes, they'd subject them to the death penalty. But what juries traditionally had the power to do, and indeed often did, was return verdicts on lesser offenses when they thought that the crime or the defendant's acts were not severe enough to trigger the death penalty. So the jury was an institution of public consciousness that was interposed between the prosecution and the judge. In other words, between the state and the state. It was the citizen's ability to have what the Supreme Court later called a check on the judiciary. And that has held true throughout, really throughout criminal jurisprudence leading up to today. And that is why I think Apprendi was an easy case, and the Supreme Court properly said, hey, if this fact subjects the defendant to extra punishment, then it ought to be proved to the jury. Now, 4 years after Apprendi, the Supreme Court had a second case, or another case in this line that I was personally involved in called Blakely against Washington. Now, Blakely against Washington, I'm going to suggest, was actually a hard case, at least a hard case for the court and a hard case for a constitutional, as a matter of constitutional interpretation. Because in the Blakely case involved a state sentencing guideline regime. And I think whatever you might want to say about the legislative action in New Jersey that gave rise to the Apprendi case, sentencing guideline regimes are certainly not intended to deprive the defendant of any rights. They're not intended to manipulate the burden of proof. What they are intended to do is to regularize criminal punishment and to give judges firm benchmarks for ratcheting up sentences when there are particularly egregious facts. And so it wasn't very easy for me as the lawyer to tell a story in Blakely that, oh, here we have sort of a historic kind of violation of the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial. We didn't even have sentencing guidelines or anything like them at the time of the founding, and so you couldn't stand there and say, well, hey, I've looked at the common law cases and they clearly say such and such. What I had to do as a lawyer was say, look, you established a principle in Apprendi that is based on originalist interpretation of the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial. Now that principle is established, you have to apply it to these modern circumstances. And the reason why is because the same problems, even though unintended, will indeed rear their ugly head if you shirk from that responsibility. And so even though sentencing guidelines were perfectly well-intentioned, and in fact I actually support sentencing guidelines so long as a matter of regimenting sentences, so long as the facts are proved to the jury and not the judge. But once they're proved to the judge, you open up the real possibility for prosecutors to charge low-level offenses and get verdicts from juries that really only themselves expose the defendants to low-level punishment. And then you allow the judge to find, based on far less rigorous standards of proof, and only one person instead of 12, and an employee of the state instead of a citizen, to subject the defendant to far greater punishment. The effect is the same. And so in Blakely, the court, by the same 5-4 majority that had ruled in Apprendi, held that the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial applied to sentencing guideline regimes. And I'm sure, as most of you know, 6 months later, the Supreme Court said the federal guideline system was subject to the same infirmity as Washington state system was. Let me outline now for you the confrontation cases, which I think you'll quickly see follow, I think, a similar story. The Sixth Amendment right to confrontation says that the defendant has the right to be, quote, confronted with the witnesses against him, unquote. But oddly enough, once the Supreme Court incorporated this right in the 60s and 70s against the states, it had sort of drifted away from that text and actually never made any attempt to tie it to any historical understanding of the Confrontation Clause. And so by the time we got to 1980, the Supreme Court decided in a case called Ohio against Roberts that what the purpose of the Confrontation Clause, at least as modern lawyers would understand it, is to guarantee the reliability of evidence through cross-examination. And so in a criminal trial, if the prosecution wanted to use out-of-court statements, what the judge should do is ask himself whether the defendant would benefit from cross-examination in this scenario. In other words, whether the evidence appeared to the judge to be reliable. And if the judge decided this looked like reliable evidence, then there wouldn't be any harm to the confrontation principle by letting it in without the defendant ever having a chance to ask a question of the witness who'd made those statements. And that remained the law for a generation. In 2004, I brought a case called Crawford against Washington where I challenged that reliability-based rationale for the Confrontation Clause. And the first thing I said was, look, I've read this text over and over again, and I don't find anything about reliability or hearsay in the text. What I see is a rule about the way the prosecution has to present its witnesses' testimony. It has to bring its witnesses into court. So the defendant can have a confrontation. That is to be, that is, so the witness can say his or her statements in the presence of the defendant, in front of the jury, and be subject to cross-examination and be under oath. And so what the Confrontation Clause is really about, as I put it and the court now has put it in Crawford, is about how witness testimony is introduced, in which, you know, and we've now boiled that down to a concept of defining testimonial statements. If a witness's statements are testimonial, whether they be in court or out of court, the confrontation right applies. And so in Crawford, the Supreme Court got there through another opinion by Justice Scalia, and it was a very, very thoroughgoing originalist opinion. I've heard him use it actually as an example of what he thinks is a model of originalism in interpretation. And I'll just give one, you know, little autobiographical note on it, why I think that Crawford rests on such firm foundations. When I was researching to write the brief for this case, I was actually living in Seattle at the time. I spent one day, actually about a week, but one particular day I remember at the University of Washington Law School Library, where I was going through dusty old treatises and common law texts and the like, trying to discern how the right to confrontation would have been understood by the founders. And among those things I found an actual copy of the trial of Sir Walter Raleigh from 1603. It's an amazing thing, but there's a volume called Howard State Trials that collects the famous state trials from England from centuries ago. And you sort of gently open the book and the dust falls out. And what you find is almost a transcript of the trial. It's remarkable. And as I read through the trial of Sir Walter Raleigh, who the Supreme Court had acknowledged on many occasions, as had many scholars, that was one of the rallying cries for the right to confrontation, because Sir Walter Raleigh had been charged with treason and a co-conspirator had made statements while in custody that were introduced against Sir Walter Raleigh over his fierce objection to bring my accuser so I can confront him face to face. But they never did, and Sir Walter Raleigh was convicted and sentenced to death. And when I read through the transcript, I saw argument after argument that the prosecution had made for introducing the co-conspirator's statement that mapped on precisely to the arguments that were made in the modern day under the Roberts framework, that this co-conspirator hadn't been given any promises of leniency. He had implicated himself in the treason. He hadn't done it under pressure from the authorities, et cetera, et cetera. All these reliability-based arguments that were laced through modern jurisprudence in this respect. And I thought, boy, if I understand that originalism doesn't always give you the answer and that sometimes it's difficult to bring the past forward to the present for purposes of understanding what the Constitution means, but boy, oh boy, if you believe it all in history, this is the modern equivalent of what happened then. So again, I think Crawford itself was rather an easy case. And again, maybe I'll be taken on that respect, but I think that was an easy case and the Supreme Court got it right. Last year, I argued another case in this line called Melendez-Diaz versus Massachusetts. And I want to suggest to you that Melendez-Diaz is, in a sense, the Blakely case in this line of jurisprudence. I think Melendez-Diaz is the hard case, whereas Crawford was the easy case. Melendez-Diaz involved the question whether, after Crawford, forensic laboratory reports are testimonial pieces of evidence so that the prosecution can't introduce forensic lab reports without bringing the person who wrote the report into court and putting the person on the stand. Now, it doesn't take much reflection to realize that if you look at the framing period for how they dealt with forensic evidence, you're not going to get real far. I can say that I did some research with a student at Stanford, and the very, very best we were able to find was a line of cases from the mid-1800s involving prosecutions for adulterating milk. And so the prosecution would bring a chemist into court who had analyzed the milk, and the chemist would testify, and he would come into court and testify that the milk had been adulterated, in his opinion. But for obvious reasons, that only goes so far, and again, what you had in Melendez-Diaz was a situation of the Supreme Court having established an originalist-based principle and now being confronted with a utterly modern question in criminal procedure and confronted with a difficult question of whether to apply that in modern times. the same five justices who I was speaking of in Apprendi and Blakely wrote an opinion, Melendez-Diaz, applying the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation in this context. It's another opinion by Justice Scalia. And the reasoning is much the same as it is in Blakely. We have a rule that is established that prohibits, another way to put this is it prohibits trial by affidavit. And what is a sworn forensic report from somebody saying that a substance is cocaine or the defendant's fingerprints are on the gun or et cetera, but the modern equivalent of an affidavit? And so even though the framers didn't precisely bite down on this question, it's appropriate to apply this rule strictly today. The dissent in Melendez-Diaz, written by Justice Kennedy, looks a lot like the dissent in Blakely, written by Justice Breyer, and a separate dissent written by Justice O'Connor. It pushes aside history very quickly and says, it's almost like saying, I don't care what the framers would have thought about this. This makes life hard. It makes life hard for prosecutors. It makes life hard for legislatures. And it's going to be too burdensome on the criminal justice system, and we're just and we're not interested in applying the rule here. So before I turn it over to Professor Bibas, let me make a few observations about why I think the Supreme Court got it right in Blakely and Melendez-Diaz, and why I think it is a welcome and appropriate development for the Supreme Court to be taking originalism seriously in criminal jurisprudence and criminal procedure, even when it's applying it to unquestionably modern circumstances. Let me give you three reasons. The first, in my mind, goes to just the very nature of a Bill of Rights. If you pick up the Bill of Rights, and particularly when we're talking about criminal procedure, if you pick up the Sixth Amendment, there aren't that many things in there. There's the right to an attorney, there's the right to trial by jury, there's the right to confront witnesses against you, and there's one or two other things. That's not a long list. And I think it's not a lot to ask. And I don't think the framers would have thought it a lot to ask, and I don't think modern judges should think it a lot to ask to apply that those few precious rights with serious vigor today as yesterday. The rules of criminal procedure, all kinds of statutory developments can do all the adjusting to modern times they want, but the robust ground rules for criminal procedure ought to be followed. Now you might say I'm begging the question when I say that because of course that depends on what it means. So let me turn to my second observation about why I think this makes sense. Again, if you care at all about originalism, and I think the court does in various ways, at least different justices do in various ways, some more than others, but I think it's undeniable that the framers were deeply, deeply suspicious of governmental power. Again, that's why the amendments were insisted on in the Constitution. And yes, as the court said in Crawford, the framers perhaps had on their minds more the great state treason trials like Sir Walter Raleigh than to take the other side of the spectrum in Melendez-Diaz, an ordinary run-of-the-mill drug possession prosecution. But I don't think that's a difference of kind. I think that, if anything, the reason the framers were worried about the great state trials because the problem of governmental overreaching in against the citizen's will. And I think that if anything in the modern day, and this is where I think I will map things onto the modern day quite explicitly, the criminal justice system, when it deals in these everyday cases, in these ordinary cases, those are the ones where I think the criminal procedure rights are most important because they're the ones where they're tend to be indigent defendant, the forgotten, the downtrodden in our society, and people who really don't have the eye of the public watching their cases. We need them to have certain backstops that they can insist on, else they just get churned through the system without any protections at all. And finally, the final reason I think these decisions are correct is, which is related, is because they curb the power of judges. which I think again was a key consideration for the framers. When you read the dissents in Melendez-Diaz and in Blakely, the overall theme in those dissents, or one of the themes, is: look, we can trust judges to do this. Why do we need to put the prosecution to regular burdens of proof to the jury? Why do they have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury? Why do they have to bring this witness in and put him on the stand so the jurors can see and the jurors can decide whether the statements are reliable? We can just trust the judges. Well, again, I have enormous respect for justices on the Supreme Court, right down to state trial judges across the country. They're all trying to do a job. But there's one thing that the framers, I think, were really worried about, was giving too much power to judges. And when judges can decide for themselves how much is too much, stick my finger in the wind and I can decide as a policy pragmatic reason when I think I should balance away the defendant's rights to the prosecution. I can tell you, as somebody that knows a little bit about the criminal justice system, whenever I pick up an opinion that says we're going to balance the interests of the state in this criminal prosecution against the interests of the defendant, I know who's going to win that case. What we need are a few firm, bright-line rules that defendants have the right to insist on when necessary, and that judges are bound to enforce even when they don't want to do so. With that, I'll turn it over.
Professor Beavis.
All right. There's a fair amount that I agree with Professor Fisher on, but it's much more interesting if I focus on things I don't. So setting aside perhaps his being a little too confident about the originalist footing of Apprendi and Crawford itself, I'm going to make three basic points. The first one is, originalism is a pretty good idea where the soil supports it, but a lot of these issues, particularly these newer ones that the court is getting into, are more of a soft ground or even a quagmire. And so you're trying to build too much of an edifice upon quicksand. It's going to sink. The second theme I'll make is that you have to be careful of what you wish for, that a lot of liberals want to go rah-rah for certain originalist little pieces, but they wouldn't like the whole package that it would take to make it consistent. Justice Thomas is willing to give us that whole package, but that whole package does not look, on balance, more favorable to defendants in some ways than the little pieces that some litigants have understandably picked out. And then the final one is, at the very end of his presentation, Professor Fisher rightly touches on the idea of some bright-line rules. But actually, there are a fair number of areas where if you follow originalism, you'll move away from bright-line rules. And Justice Scalia likes originalism. He likes formalism. But there are some places where you really have to pick between the two. And so sometimes it'll lead us away from things like the exclusionary rule that others would have embraced because it's relatively simple, it's clear, it tells police exactly what to do. All right, so the first point, let's start by talking about these points in the context of the jury trial and sentencing cases. In terms of whether the ground here is soft enough to be a quagmire, I'd say the text doesn't define what's a trial or a criminal prosecution. Did it include sentencing? Well, there was no sentencing phase in the 18th century. There was some evidence that juries knew of the punishments, more so in England than in America, but certainly there's some evidence out there. But nothing like what the modern sentencing proceeding looks like. And Professor Fisher concedes, certainly by the time we get to sentencing guidelines and all of the hot issues in litigation today, we don't have a lot to build on there. In terms of being careful what you wish for in this area, well, let's take a look at what this jury trial would have looked like if we were giving the jury the power to sentence openly. We'd also be abolishing peremptory challenges. We'd be abolishing voir dire. We'd run criminal cases in an hour or half an hour. I don't think there are a lot of defense lawyers who'd like that. In terms of, we want rules to constrain judges, well, we'd be getting rid of jury instructions where the judges define mens rea for the jury. Jury would just decide, are you bad? Are you wicked? Right? That's not a very pro-defendant kind of ruling. I might be comfortable with it, but I think a lot of the newfound fringes of originalism might not be. Would we be abolishing or constricting the rules of evidence? let in past criminal records. Back then, you could tell someone had a felony. He was branded on the thumb or something like that. So the jury knew this was a bad guy. We don't need to cut him leniency this time. These days, we don't let any of that in. And so, again, if you're going to trust the jury one way, you ought to trust the jury the other way. But I think people want to kind of have the part of the cake, the icing that's good for the defendants, and not maybe the other parts that cut against them. And likewise, knowing the punishment, simplifying jury instructions would conversely give judges a lot more free hand to voice their own views. Professor Fisher says, well, one of the themes here is curbing the power of judges. Back in the 18th century, judges had tons of power to comment on the evidence, to make their views known, to lean on juries, short of throwing them in prison. But they could really lean hard and tell them, you know, the evidence here, there's only one way you can read it. And the jury could do what it wanted with it, but they weren't so timid. There wasn't the risk of reversal on appeal or habeas. Sentences were carried out right away. So judges had more authority in a lot of ways then. Finally, if we were going to do the originalism, we'd have to do much more. We'd have to follow Justice Thomas's opinions. He's the most consistent to his logical conclusion. We'd be abolishing the exclusionary rules, right? So not formalism, it'd be originalism there. And we'd be abolishing plea bargaining. We'd have 20 times more trials. Enormous practical problem. But no one except Justice Thomas on the court is willing to go that far. It's not even clear he would go that far. And so you have this odd situation where on the court you have one or two committed originalists, and then you have several other justices who are fair-weather originalists. They're really motivated by an individual fairness interpretation that is more at home in the Due Process Clause, frankly. So you get these bizarre things where the court won't follow a principle consistently. It'll only go so far, and not far enough to prevent circumvention in plea bargaining, etc. So the Supreme Court strikes down, it finds a way to uphold the federal sentencing guidelines in Booker, because Justice Breyer is wedded to them, having been the architect, and manages to woo Justice Ginsburg back over by saying, oh, they're fair enough. But strikes down state sentencing guidelines that are widely recognized as being fairer to defendants, less constricting, doing less in the way of giving judges power to augment sentences with relevant conduct and the like. So when you don't have a consistent coalition of five originalists on the Supreme Court, you're going to get a hash out of the court if it tries to pick and choose and dip in, because the other justices won't put together a coherent package that would have made sense and would prevent circumvention, right? Now, on to how those ideas I talked about apply in the Confrontation Clause area. I agree with Professor Fisher. It's a good thing that when you have a clear central case that the provision was designed to deal with, you should deal with it today too, clearly. And that's true of the equivalent of the Walter Raleigh trials, where the government is trying to railroad a defendant, especially a political defendant, and trying to circumvent proof in open court. It shouldn't be able to hide behind it. Now, behind depositions or worse than depositions, sorry, just ex parte interviews by officials of the state. Even there, there's a little bit of historical room to question. The Marion Justice of the Peace provisions did allow justices of the peace to do some examinations in America in the 18th century before trial went ahead and those statements could be used. But let's set aside that quibble, all right? So we agree. The government should not be able to get around bringing in a witness it can bring into trial. But let's talk about some other situations. How about 911 calls? Did those exist in the framing era? No, right? We can extrapolate some general ideas about 911 calls, but you're kind of having to make it up with, at best, some general guidance or themes. There's not a bright line rule that comes out here. How about these questioning of a rape victim gently by a battered woman's advocate or something like that? Is that the same kind of thing that the framers are trying to get at? Not really. You might be able to extend some of those principles a little bit, but you have to be very cautious because it's not the same set of considerations that the framers were even dealing with. It's also worth noting that the rules of evidence and the way that the courts approached confrontation was hugely in flux in the 18th century. And so it's fair to say that Professor Fisher's approach, which he's persuaded the court, and I admire him for doing, persuaded the court Melendez-Diaz to adopt, freezes in place a snapshot of a law that was not really codified, that was in flux in the late 18th century. So, for example, there were no lab examiners, right? Now, with the lab examiner cases, I have a little bit of sympathy for Professor Fisher's position, because there, we actually do have some scandals in America of labs taking, you know, not failing to test things, and then it turns out it's powdered sheetrock rather than cocaine. There have been some scandals, and also it's usually possible to rerun many of these tests. But those are functionalist arguments that confirm for us that the formalist or originalist reading is not ridiculous or disastrous, right? So formalism and functionalism, originalism and modernism kind of work together there. But let's take a different example. Let's take coroner inquests, all right? When, in a drug case, you're usually doing the exam and calling the drug tester within a year after the drug test has been done. But murders have no statutes of limitations, right? So, and the murderer may be on the lam, may run away, and may be tried 10 or 20 years later. Well, the autopsy was done long ago. Coroner may be dead, long gone. Even if the coroner's around, what's the coroner going to do? Does the coroner have an independent memory of what the one out of 1,000 autopsies he did 15 or 20 years ago? No. He just reads it, and under that fiction of recollection or flesh, he says, yes, in fact, this is what, I found this above the spleen, and so on and so forth. So there's not great history that says we have to reach this result based on the 18th century, and there are very substantial policy and common sense reasons not to. Indeed, there are good reasons to think the framers would not have pushed it that far. It's just that they articulated a slogan without fleshing out its outer limits. And so I think we need to be very careful, particularly about what Professor Fisher says about turning it into a bright line rule where it's not been so clear. So the final thing is that I think if you focus on originalism, sometimes you look at this only as a minimum. As Professor Fisher said, this is just about a few things that are in there, and it's not about a whole bunch of other things we can trust the rules of criminal procedure to update. And in fact, if you want to look at seriously at what it takes to confront complicated scientific and forensic evidence, note the word is not cross-examine, it's confront. So that would imply it should include more things. What does it take to produce an effective cross-examination? Support for, you know, forensic experts and other things like that. But an originalist focus might distract from serving those originalist values in more modern ways. And so I guess my bottom line is two cheers, not three, for originalism. I think it works pretty well in those core cases like the Sir Walter Raleigh cases, but I think a lot of what's being litigated today are not those core cases, as Professor Fisher effectively concedes, and I think there are real dangers in taking what was an evolving rule and freezing it into a slogan that can be both over and under-inclusive.
Thank you for your presentations. Very interesting. We've talked about a reply because we've gone so long. 1 minute, gentlemen.
Okay, got it. My white light is on, huh?
Except I'm not as ruthless as the Chief Justice.
Let me say one thing about each of these two areas. And first, just to be clear about what my position is, as I suspect you would realize, I'm not advocating, when I advocate originalism and criminal procedure, returning whole hog to what a trial looked like in 1791. Of course I'm not. When I advocate for the right to jury trial, I'm not advocating for returning to a system of 12 white male landowners on a jury, or all the other things Professor Bibas would point out. But I don't think that's any inconsistency with my position. Again, none of those things are required as part of the defendant's constitutional rights. All I'm insisting on is that these notions, jury trial, confrontation, as they were understood to be protections for the defendant, are the purpose of the Bill of Rights, and those things should be brought dealt with, and appropriately so, and thank goodness, by modernization and innovation in criminal procedure and evidence and all the like. So I don't see why you'd have to bring forward everything about what a trial looked like in 1791 to today. And the second thing, I'll just say a quick word about Melendez-Diaz, and I'm grateful to hear at least I have some measure of agreement there. I will say that even though I called it today a hard case, I was actually surprised to lose 4 votes in that case on all 4 people who decided it on the functionalist grounds, because for the reasons Professor Biba said, I would have thought I had a pretty good story to tell about the practical horrors that we know of from the past generation of unchecked lab work. And so it just shows, I think, how once you get off the rails, though, and judges can do whatever they want, things get really hard. You mentioned something about autopsy reports, and let me just say, as another example of bringing originalism forward to today, that you know this is, I think, the hardest question in this field. At least it's the one that hits you in the gut the most. But it's always been the rule, and I guarantee you, if you look at the history, it is absolutely rock solid that if any other witness became unavailable for trial, if you had a murder case where somebody had witnessed the murder, and then you don't catch the guy until 10 years later and don't bring him to trial until 10 years later, and the one eyewitness who knew exactly what happened and could recite it in court has now died, then the prosecution would be out of luck and wouldn't be able to use that witness's statements. And so I think there are lots of things labs can do in the autopsy context, having 2 people in the room, videotaping them, etc., to find ways to get around the confrontation clause and satisfy it in other ways. But again, when you have a problem and when the witness can't be in court, you know, I'm prepared to insist on enforcing the right.
All right. Let me just respond only to the first of those points, which was, why is it that we can't just give defendants some of these pieces and not go backwards on others? I take Professor Fisher's theory on the jury trial to be the jury is not there just to be a fact finder. It's to express the conscience of the community and to do full moral judgment on what this defendant deserves. Well, the full moral judgment requires the full picture involved at sentencing. It requires the stuff that's kept up by the rules of evidence. It requires the prior criminal record. It requires the evidence that was kept out by the exclusionary rules. I don't think you can say we're going to give the jury the power to do this moral judgment, but we're going to put a thumb on the scales and keep them from hearing the things that really give them the full balanced picture.
In fine Federalist Society tradition, those of you who have questions, if you would now come to the microphones on the side, and while cues are forming, I will exercise the moderator's privilege and ask the first question. Sentencing and punishment has been one of the areas where, over the last 2 centuries, we've seen the most development in theories. So 100 years ago, there was a strong belief in rehabilitation. Again, the word penitentiary came from the word penitent. And there's a very famous building here called Eastern State Penitentiary. If you want to see ancient theories of penology, they actually built the architecture in ways that would encourage people to become better human beings. We've now abandoned that, and in that we had indeterminate sentencing where it was determined by a parole board how long you stayed in prison. And we've now moved to a world where there's greater taking it away from judges altogether, and now we have sentencing guidelines. And we've had a tremendous revolution in both the mechanisms and the theories that we are trying to accomplish through punishment. How would your points of view accommodate all this learning about how people change and their capacity to change, and how can we design a legal system that reflects that adequately?
Well, there's no doubt there have been a lot of changes over time in what we're trying to accomplish by putting somebody into prison. Without going on for too long, I think that the way to do the analysis as a modern-day originalist is to look at why we're putting them in prison today and compare that to why they were putting them in prison in 1791. And when it comes to modern sentencing laws, I think the equivalence is quite strong because the modern principle behind sentencing is explicit in the federal sentencing guidelines in the move to that and has been mirrored in the states is to punish. It is not to rehabilitate. So when you apply the historical principle of the jury had to find facts that expose the defendant to greater punishment, or to put it another way, that any fact that made the crime more serious needed to be proved to the jury, I think it maps on quite well today. I think it would be a much, much harder – it would have been a much harder argument to have 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. But the way that we do things today, I think, implicates quite strongly the historical reason for having juries.
I think while Professor Fisher has an important originalist point, I think what's perverse about the way the court has developed in this area is it said, okay, let's leave – indeterminate, unstructured sentencing constitutional, let's only regulate it originally when we give judges more guidance within that 0 to 20-year range on how to do things. I'd get it if you were being Justice Thomas and saying, fine, we're going to go back to saying the jury has to do everything. But it creates quite perverse incentives to say you can give unfettered discretion to the judge, but if the legislature starts to guide the judge, then suddenly that turns it into a sentencing factor for the jury. It's a very odd bird, and that's what leads us to a Sixth Amendment line of cases. It's about protecting juries, and Justice Breyer's big triumph is in Booker. He writes this opinion that's all about restoring discretion to judges by loosening up the federal sentencing guidelines. And it has nothing to do with juries by that point. And so I think, you know, again, a little originalism is a dangerous thing. I think if we were willing to actually go back, it would work better as a package. But it has a real potential, kind of half-hearted originalism, to thwart many of the important developments in guiding, in regulating, in giving more due process notice and more procedural protections to defendants than they had up until the 1970s, say.
Can I say a quick word? I think it's important to, for the purposes of the debate, to understand. I think, just for your purpose, just for information, what almost all the states have done in response to this line of cases is step in and keep their sentencing guidelines, but have the juries find those extra facts. And I think that tells you an interesting thing about originalism and its consequences here, is that there's another part to this story, which is leaving things properly to the democratic process. And I would argue, and this is a much bigger debate, but just to point it out, that Justice Breyer, when he stepped in Booker and created this amalgam system, did more harm than good. And if we would have left it to the legislature, we might be on a firm footing like we are in the states, where the right is actually protected through the democratic process.
Start on this side, please.
Thank you so much for this discussion. I think this is really the cutting edge of originalism, so I really do enjoy this. My question is for Professor Fisher. I find myself more on your side on these issues as I studied them. And my question is, how does forfeiture by wrongdoing fit into the original understanding of confrontation clause, the original understanding of the confrontation clause?
So the question for people in the audience, the forfeiture doctrine provides that if the prosecution wants to use a testimonial statement of a witness and the witness is unavailable, the defendant cannot object on confrontation grounds. He's forfeited his confrontation right if he is the cause of the witness's unavailability. And so the paradigm case, imagine the mobster facing trial has the prosecution's star witness killed on the night before he's going to testify. That person cannot go in and invoke his right to confrontation. That rule, I think, is a perfect example of originalism in practice today, because when you look at the history of the right to confrontation, which, as Professor Beavis points out, the Constitution only gives us so many words. What they do is they memorialize concepts that were understood at the time. And the way the right to confrontation was understood clearly at the founding was that it's a defendant's right, but he does indeed forfeit it if he purposefully keeps the witness away from court. And so what the Supreme Court did in a case called Giles a couple years ago was say that that same historical understanding of the right to confrontation is going to be enforced today as well.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
On this side, please.
Thank you. I'd like to echo the thanks for a wonderful conversation today. For Professor Bibas, you spoke of the difficulty the right to confrontation creates with regard to medical examiners and raised that as a problem. With the implications of a murder conviction and with the unique role a coroner has in shaping the fact-finding and being, in many cases, the sole person capable of testifying as to the cause of death itself, why is that problem? Shouldn't that burden be even stronger in those instances because of that unique nature?
Well, I guess it depends on what you think the purpose is of confrontation. And I think with fact witnesses, it's pretty clear, it's pretty obvious. Our system trusts looking them in the eye, gauging their credibility, their ability to perceive, their demeanor, any number of things that maybe are not as central when you have a witness who is essentially going to be reading a business record. And then you get into a discussion of what the general practices are in that coroner's office. Now, I think there's an argument that maybe this ought to be understood as a best evidence type rule, right? If the coroner's available, call him. But there are other ways to prove what the standard practice and procedure of the office was. Does the office have a significant error rate? Are there other reasons to question? There are provisions in the rules of evidence for impeaching an unavailable declarant by bringing out that the person had testified falsely, had problems in other cases. There are other ways to get at this when the declarant's unavailable. It just strikes me that, you know, there's costs, there's benefits here, but it's not clear why we should freeze them in amber when it's not kind of the classic, the government is trying to circumvent, you're looking the fact witness in the eye kind of situation. And the history is just not so clear.
We have two questions left, and if we do this lightning round style, we can get them both in. So if you would keep your questions and answers short.
Yes, I'll be very quick. So the discussion this morning is focused on the Sixth Amendment, and it seems to me that perhaps the Sixth Amendment for originalists is actually a relatively easy case, and that maybe the more difficult amendment is the Fourth. So my question for both of you is, how should the Fourth Amendment inform the court's, or how should originalism inform the court's construction of the Fourth Amendment?
A short answer to that. Okay.
Aren't you supposed to see my book or something?
So I will say in brief that I agree, I think, with something Professor Bibas said earlier, which is originalism doesn't always lead to bright line rules. Because originalism has a close cousin in textualism. And when you look at the Fourth Amendment and you see the word reasonable, it's hard for me to believe that the framers meant to freeze in time whatever the exact practices were in 1791. It seems to me to give some measure of flexibility looking forward. So I think that the practices in 1791 and historical worries that are behind Fourth Amendment ought to matter, but I think there ought to be more flexibility in a provision like that precisely because of the different text than in the Sixth Amendment.
Right. I agree, and it's difficult in a context like Kylo with thermal imaging devices that didn't exist, where you draw analogs to whether people could have seen the snow melting on top of someone's house to tell whether it was hot or not. But I do have to say, one theme on which I tend to agree with Professor Fisher is that sometimes modern judges are all caught up in whether substantively this looks fair or not. But maybe we ought to be doing things like worrying whether the procedures are structured in a way that get us to determining whether it's reasonable or not. And my old mentor, Akhil Amar, who'll talk this afternoon, has written and said, look, the framers trusted juries. You could let juries decide ex post whether a search was reasonable to deal with, well, is it reasonable to hack someone's Facebook account or not? I mean, the framers didn't have an answer, but they would have left it to the jury to figure that out. Or they would have left it maybe to the legislature. Maybe legislatures could come up with, well, what does the average Facebook user think about that? But there are ways short of inventing this exclusionary rule with a warrant requirement that doesn't really fit the Facebook hacking context, to let the legislature and the juries and other actors develop the law. And so I would suggest that this may not be an area where we want judges coming up with a ton of ex ante rules necessarily. at least until we've gotten an accretion of case law that says, yes, there's a settled consensus in our society that hacking a Facebook account is unreasonable or a drug test in this particular circumstance is unreasonable. That's a reason for deference to the democratic processes to let a consensus evolve rather than freezing it in place, especially with new technologies.
Last question.
Professor Fisher, I wanted to ask you about Melendez-Diaz. As someone who did scientific research before I went to law school, I'm concerned that some of the extension of the confrontation clause in this ground has to do with confusing what is essentially scientific fact, which is always expressed in terms of probabilities and percentages, with more run-of-the-mill opinions or conclusions. But in the interest of time, I'll confine myself to one small area. You and Professor Beavis discussed the issue of autopsies, and you suggested that maybe one answer to the problem would be videotaping the evidence. Now, why is that so much better than a written report of the autopsy? Why would that be admissible as opposed to the written report when you're going to have the same commentary and conclusions by the coroner on the videotape?
Thanks for the question. And I was not perfectly precise when I mentioned that. What I mean is a videotape just like pictures. So that I would certainly object to an audio commentary going along with the autopsy in a way that would violate the Confrontation Clause just like a report would if the witness weren't present. But pictures or video can be a way of preserving, you know, here's where the scar is on the right arm, so that a new scientist could be on the stand and say, I'm looking at this picture on the video, and now I can opine about this. I would certainly not let the original coroner's words come in. But that's the kind of creative way to try to fend off the problem that I'm talking about. Let me just say a quick word about your first comment, though. That was one of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts' lead arguments in Melendez-Diaz. Hey, these are scientific facts. They're not opinion. Now, I hope I can say without any disrespect for the scientific method that a lot of what goes on in forensic scientists in science is quite subjective. And even when it's not, it still depends on expertise and care and analysis in a way that I can't see how it's different than any other witness. And so, again, to draw the analogy that I at least advocate doing between the history and the past and the present, when a witness says, I saw a blue car go speeding down the street just past midnight, that is an objective, verifiable fact one way or the other, and that's always something we've understood to be subject to the right to confrontation. I don't know how it's any different than the scientist who says, I've tested this powder and it seems to me to be cocaine.
Thank you.
Please join me in thanking Professors Fisher and Beavis for a great time.
That was more fun.